Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Jacopo Carucci, a.k.a. Jacopo Pontormo, was a leader of the Mannerist movement that dominated Italian painting in the 16th century. Michelangelo once predicted that a 19-year-old Pontormo will exalt this art to the heavens. The Morgan Library and Museum is currently featuring a small exhibit of Pontormo's works, including his 1528 painting Visitation that's in the United States for the first time. It's on loan from a little-known church near Florence, and the New Yorker magazine has called it one of the damnedest great paintings of all time. Mary Hogan Kemp is the docent supervisor at the Morgan and an independent art historian who wrote her thesis about Pontormo. She joins us now to talk about his life, his work, and her experience writing a thesis about an artist about whom very little is known. I'm pleased to welcome Mary Hogan Kemp to our show. Hi.
Thank you, Leonard. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jacopo Carucci was born in 1494. When did he become known as Pontormo?
I think when he was around 20 years old, and it was very common at that time for artists to develop a nickname.
Often it was based on their hometown.
Yes, and that's what his came from.
What do we know about his early life?
Well, we know that as a small boy, he was born in Pontormo. His father was a painter who had been a disciple of Ghirlandaio and who had a successful painting career in the Valdano Valley, but he died when Pontormo was about 5 years old, and when he was 10, his mother died, and he was raised in part by his grandmother, Mona Brigida. And one very interesting thing, we know a little bit about his life because Vasari wrote about him, and he said that Mona Brigida taught him the elements of Latin grammar and writing. So it appears that he was fairly well educated.
On the other hand, we know very little about his life.
We know very little about his life.
Vasari only gave us certain kinds of details.
Yeah, Vasari was...
he's not the greatest art historian, but he's all we have.
You know, he's an incredible art historian, I think, but he, particularly on people that were his own peers, he was a prejudiced writer. He had his own agenda, and you have to very carefully sort out what that agenda was.
Because he was also a painter.
Because he was
and
a painter.
And Pontormo was competition?
Pontormo had the job that he wanted, which was court artist to the Medici, so he was after that job.
Didn't Pontormo apprentice to Leonardo da Vinci?
Yes, he did, probably very briefly. When he was about 13 years old, he went to Florence, and Vasari reports that he was with Leonardo, but then he quickly... all the big artists were at that point leaving Florence because the jobs were in Rome, so he probably was with Leonardo for about a year. Then he went to Mariotto Albertinelli. Then he went to Piero di Cosimo. And finally, he went to Andrea del Sarto.
But not Michelangelo, even though they seem to have been kindred spirits in some ways.
I think they were kindred spirits. They knew each other. They were definitely friends. But no, Michelangelo, I don't think, ever had a studio in which he took in students.
He hope to compete with Michelangelo? Wasn't everyone who followed Michelangelo kind of competing with him?
Absolutely. I mean, this is an era. He's the generation after Michelangelo, Leonardo, Raphael. I mean, this is like, you know, being born on the 5th of July. You know, your birthday party is always a lesser event. And they had to figure out a way to meet and exceed what had been done in the generation before them.
Because of all of those giants.
Because of those giants, yeah. I mean, it was it was really an intimidating situation to face, I think.
So that's how we wound up with mannerism, from the Italian word, maniere.
Yes. Well, yes, although I think you have to say that Michelangelo himself became a mannerist as time went on. So it wasn't, you know, they just had to find their own individual way, and it was very challenging.
So how would you define mannerism as opposed, it's the style that follows the High Renaissance?
Yes.
And is it a reaction to the High Renaissance?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that. I mean, if you think about the Renaissance, the artists have discovered, you know, one-point perspective. They can do things absolutely realistically. They can make you, you know, they can make you believe that a cup of wine is right in front of you. So the next thing to do, I guess, is to become more abstract, more expressionistic, you know, more, put more emotion in it, remove it from reality and kind of go beyond that.
And how would you spot a Pontormo? How is he different from his contemporaries?
Well, Pontormo has these wonderful elongated figures. He has this incredible palette that looks like, you know, every flavor of sherbet.
He loved pastel colors.
He did. I mean, they're
pinks and
yes, I mean,
baby
they're,
blues.
They're quite vivid colors, actually, but they are these almost like fluorescent colors. And he does figures that are very elongated, but they also have this amplitude. You know, they're not flimsy, and yet they have this lightness. So he always is combining kind of extremes.
He once stated that the nature of art is to surpass nature.
Yes, superare la natura. Yes, that was his.
And that was the title of your thesis?
Yes, that's right. It was. And I thought that was so interesting. He wrote one letter in his life, and it was for a competition in which the best artists and sculptors of Florence came together, and they had to debate which was better, sculpture or painting. And so he wrote a letter and submitted it, and in it he said, you know, sculptors have a really hard job. You know, they've got to do things like undercut. They've got to have an arm sticking up in the air with an object in it. You know, it can't get harder than that. He said, but you know, actually think about painters, because you have color. And with color, you have to not only imitate nature, but you've got to go beyond nature. And he said, and then he cracks a joke. And he says, if you think about it, when God made the world, he did it in three dimensions. He skipped the hard part into two dimensions.
He was a lot kinder to sculpture than Ad Reinhardt was many years later, when Ad Reinhardt said, sculpture is the stuff you bump into when you're backing up to look at the painting.
Exactly. but actually, in that letter, he took on Michelangelo. He said, you know, Michelangelo's here for sculpture, but actually I think he was a much better painter than he was ever a sculptor. So
I don't think most people would agree with him.
I don't know. Do you?
He was pretty good. Well, I think he was pretty good on both.
Yeah, I think he was a great painter.
Why did Pontormo stay in Florence his whole life? You mentioned that all those other artists were leaving for Rome, then Venice later, because they had become the important artistic centers.
Well, we don't really know why he stayed. One good reason is that he bought land and built a house and had a studio there. But also, I think you have to decide. It was a tough time to stay in Florence. He must have really loved Florence.
So is that a bad career decision?
No, I think it was fine. I think he did just fine.
Was the Florentine Republic typical of other communities that governed themselves at that time in the 16th century?
Well, it was a city-state, and this was kind of the end of the era of city-states, because you had in France on one side and in Germany on the other, you had the Habsburgs and the Valois kind of making these giant monarchies. So they were typical of what had been, but they were kind of at the end of the line.
But Florence was different than Venice, for example, which had more of a democratic side. Florence was not a democracy.
No, and really neither was Venice. I mean, Florence called itself a republic, but it was very definitely an oligarchy. There was an elite ruling class, and it was
with the Medicis at the top.
Well, 100 years before Pontormo, they weren't. They were a company of equals. But in the 100 years leading up to the time of Pontormo, the Medici kind of zeroed in and relentlessly pursued an agenda in which they became the absolute rulers.
And we think of the Medicis as patrons of the arts. Did they have good eyes for art?
Yes, they did. They had excellent eyes, some better than others. One in particular was Ottaviano de' Medici, who was a contemporary of Pontormo's. He was a fabulous connoisseur. He was unfailing in who he picked. Lorenzo the Magnificent was also a great connoisseur. Duke Cosimo, who came later, was not quite as good, but...
Well, they did wind up commissioning Michelangelo to do a whole bunch of things. So.
Yes, they did. They not only commissioned him, they saw his talent, and they brought him into their household and raised him. He was raised with the two popes, Pope Leo and Pope Clement. They all went to school together in the Medici household.
Why did the head of the Medici family, Pope Clement VII, ask the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, to send a huge imperial army to overthrow the Florentine Republic?
Well, Clement was called the unfortunate pope, and he was the illegitimate son of Lorenzo the Magnificent's brother, who was killed in the Pazzi conspiracy. So he always everything.
How did he wind up becoming a pope? Did they just simply the Medicis had so much clout that
they had so much clout, and they said that as he was dying in the Pazzi conspiracy, his father whispered to Lorenzo that he was secretly married to the mother of Giulio. So they erased his illegitimacy and made him a pope. But in 1527. The Habsburg contingent kind of overran Italy, and they sacked Rome. And when they sacked Rome, Clement had to flee for his life. And at that moment, back in Florence, when they heard the news, the Florentines, who were never very well resolved to Medici domination of Florence, took the opportunity to throw out the Medici government. And so after that, Pope Clement signed a treaty with Charles V, who had just defeated him in Rome. And he said, okay, I'll do whatever you want as long as you give me Florence. So Charles V then marched off to Florence, surrounded it, and laid siege to Florence.
And how long did the siege last?
It lasted for a little over 10 months.
As time passed and food ran out and disease spread all over the place?
Yes, it was a time of great privation. The Florentines had not really figured a way to have a supply conduit in or out. So it was a very difficult time for them.
And I would assume that's why they eventually surrendered.
Yeah. I mean, it was inevitable that they were going to have to surrender, but yes, it.
Did any of Florence's artists join in the fight against the Medici?
Yes, actually. Andrea del Sarto was part of the army. He caught the plague and died. And Michelangelo became commander of the defenses of Florence and designed a structure that was a wall, an artillery wall that they fought used to fight against them.
We forget that Michelangelo also had an architectural side. But it is interesting that these Renaissance artists could do so many different things. Leonardo inventing all sorts of armaments and flying machines and the like, and Michelangelo as well. He wasn't just painting and sculpting.
No, in fact, it was a really innovative structure that he made. He cut down, he decided to raise...
Can you imagine Jeff Koons doing any of this?
Well, he might surprise us, Jeff Koons.
No.
He'd hire somebody to do it and claim it was his.
Anyway, I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's right. He took a mile-wide swath and cut down everything, tore down all the villas, cut down all the trees all the way around Florence. And he took all that earth and trees and rubble, and he built them into this incredibly thick wall that sort of it angled out almost like a stepped pyramid, and it actually kind of revolutionized how fortress walls were built, and that's what caused the siege to happen. When Charles's army showed up, they realized they couldn't penetrate this wall, and that's what allowed them to last 10 months.
What about Pontormo? Do we know if he was active in the resistance?
Pontormo was not a soldier. I think the only way in which he was active was in the art that he was producing.
I'm speaking with Mary Hogan Camp, the docent supervisor at the Morgan Library and Museum, which has a new exhibit of featuring some works by Pontormo, the great Italian mannerist painter. And I guess I was surprised at first that it wound up at the Morgan and not at the Frick or the Metropolitan Museum of Art, because this is a really an exciting show of a major artist who doesn't get much exposure in the United States.
Yeah. Well, we have the perfect spot for showing it. We have this studiolo space. You know, it's a perfect square, a perfect cube. And I have to say that the altarpiece looks fabulous in this setting. It's as if it was made for it. It becomes like a small chapel.
And the Morgan has shown art in the past as well, so this is part of what its mission, I guess, in New York. We tend to think of it more as a library.
Well, I tend to think of it as a very tiny British museum, because actually, if you think about it, we have the cylinder seals, which go to 4000 BC, and we show Cy Twombly, and mm-hmm. we cover everything.
Following the siege of Florence, did the Medici family return to power?
Yes, they did. They marched into power, and within a few years, they'd actually established they were dukes. They were declared dukes by Charles V. And that
so this was a ducal...
It becomes a ducal kingdom, which went on for the next 200 years. This was the end. That was the last gasp of the Republic.
And was this good for Pontormo's career?
Yes, it turned out to be fine for his career. He became the first court artist to the Medici. And sadly, a lot of the work that he did in this phase is lost, because he did he decorated the villas of both Duke Alessandro and Duke Cosimo, and those have been lost to time. They haven't survived, so we have some drawings left from them. But we don't get to see some of the major work that he did for them. But he collected a salary for the rest of his life from the Medici.
But he's also painting members of the resistance, portraits of them.
Well, he painted those up until the time that the resistance was squashed. I mean, it ended very abruptly.
Tell us about the powerful and wealthy Pinadori family.
The Pinadori family are the ones who commissioned the Visitation, which is at the Morgan right now. And they were a family that they were called Speciale. They imported all the pigments and materials that painters would use. So it's very interesting. I mean, the wonderful colors that are in this altarpiece probably were supplied by the patron himself. They were anti-Medici. Mm-hmm. This panel was probably done during the time of the resistance.
And it was, even though it's a religious painting, it was designed for their villa?
Yes, we believe that it was designed for their villa. And there's a guidebook, I think, from the 1700s that places it into, you know, they report that there's a wonderful painting by Pontormo out at their villa. And it's sometime in the 18th century that it starts being reported being in the church that's in Carmignano.
Do we know why it was moved to this church? The church is called Pieve dei Santi Michele e Francesco.
Well, it was
forgive my Italian.
No, I think you're doing pretty well.
It's a small parish church.
Well, it's slightly larger. A Pieve means that they have a baptistry and they serve a larger area. So it's not quite just a local parish. It's one step up, but it is the closest church to them. And their villa no longer exists. So, I mean, something happened where they moved it. The family probably died out, or it's unclear. You know, the gap is not answered for.
Why would they want a painting of this biblical story? What's the story of the Visitation, and why would somebody want it in his or her private home?
Well, scholars have kind of figured out that this is the story. This is a story that comes out of the Gospel of Luke, in which the Virgin Mary has, you know, she's had an angel come to her who said, "You are pregnant with what will be God, you know, the Son of God who's come to save mankind," and at that moment, after the angel has come, she realizes that her cousin, her distant cousin Elizabeth, who is much older than her and who has been barren for her whole life, much to her sadness, is also pregnant. She just knows this. And so she determines that she'll travel to the town of Judah where Elizabeth is and be with her in her pregnancy. And so this panel depicts the moment when Elizabeth and Mary come together and they both know that they're with child and that it's a miraculous event.
And Elizabeth's child is John the Baptist.
Is John the Baptist, who's the last prophet before Christ.
And their stories intertwine after they're born as well.
Absolutely, yes. And so,
after all, isn't right. John the Baptist baptizes Jesus?
Yes, he does. So right. This is a fulfillment, you know, of all the. This is the coming of Christ. So, it's in a very important moment in Christian, in the Christian doctrine, and we see them just. I mean, this is a painting in which they're in motion. They're coming together, and we absolutely. Their robes are kind of billowing a little bit, and they're up on their toes as if they're in motion, and their arms have just reached out and touched. And it says in the gospel that the moment when Mary touched Elizabeth, that the John the Baptist leaped up in her womb, and they were cleansed of original sin. He and Elizabeth were cleansed of original sin at that moment.
Because Mary had already been cleansed of original sin. Many people don't realize that the Immaculate Conception was not Jesus.
No.
It was Mary born without original sin.
That's exactly right, yeah.
So when you look at this painting, you get a sense that Pontormo brilliantly captured this intensely private nature of this meeting. Did he do something specific to do that, or is it just that it's a great painting?
Well, this is quintessential Pontormo. If you look at this painting, these women, their arms kind of form a circle. And inside that circle, there's almost like the Virgin Mary's face is in shadow, and yet there's this kind of bounced light that makes her glow. And, you know, they talk about women having this certain look when they're pregnant, you know, the glow of pregnancy. They both women absolutely have that. And you really see it. I mean, he's got this perfectly, that they have this wonderful secret and this new life.
But there are actually four figures in the painting.
Yes. Yeah, there are two figures that stand behind them. And there's been lots of speculation about what they are. I go with the explanation that they're two attendants. And what Pontormo has done, you know, this is supposed to be a hill town in Judah, you know, in the Middle East, but in fact it's a very Tuscan setting. And these are elegant Tuscan women who wouldn't be seen on the street without their attendants. So he's following all the conventions of, Tuscan manners.
Wasn't that typical of Renaissance art, in fact, even pre-Renaissance art, to set all these biblical scenes in contemporary Florence?
Yes, it was.
I guess that was a way for the people who saw the paintings to connect to them.
Yes.
There was no attempt to say, they're wearing the clothing of ancient times, and these settings are what ancient Israel would have looked like.
Yeah, and very interestingly, I think this fits with that. You look at one of the attendant that's with Elizabeth, who stands between the two women, looks out at us. Mm-hmm. She makes direct eye contact at the viewer. And that also, that's part of this connection that they were trying. They were always looking to help people meditate on these events. And so the contemporary clothes and the direct gaze are ways of inviting you in.
But did people wear clothing that were in so bright and almost fluorescent colors?
Well, in Florence, they might have. They were known for. I'm just joking, though. Probably they didn't. I mean, they were very into cloth. They were cloth merchants, and they loved color, and they were very into textiles. But no, this is a heightened reality that he's presenting there.
And if we look carefully, we see two men engaged in conversation in the bottom left corner. Why are these figures so small and so sketchy?
Well, these figures actually have just become much more clear with the restoration, so it's really interesting. And if you peer even further into the picture, at the corner, the distant corner where they're sitting, there's the head of a donkey that peers around. I think what he's doing is providing the iconography that lets you know who's here, because Mary and Joseph are always accompanied by their donkey, right? And so it's probably Joseph and Elizabeth's husband, Zachariah, and they're probably chatting about the fact that, you know, here's their wives pregnant and they've never had sex.
some people have thought that they were tradesmen.
Yes. Hmm. In fact, I think the New Yorker said something about they look like two gay guys out chatting. So people have said all kinds of things about this. But and we don't know for sure. But Pontormo does tend to give you iconographic hallmarks in every picture that he does. So I think it's reasonable to say that they are the two husbands.
And would people who were looking at the paintings at the time that have understood what he was doing there?
Yes.
You said that we've only recently learned about these two men. That's because the painting has been restored.
Yes, that's right. It was, you know, these paintings sat on altars for hundreds of years where there were candles burning all the time. So I actually went to see this in Carmignano about 6 or 7 years ago, before it had been taken off the wall to be cleaned.
This is in oil, right?
Yes, it's oil. And it was really grimy. I mean, that was just murk down there. You couldn't see anything in it.
Partly because often they were in churches where the candles were lit all the time.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, there was always black smoke hitting them for hundreds of years.
The Morgan exhibition also features a preparatory drawing for the Visitation. Is this the only known drawing?
Yes, it is. It's the only one, and it's a kind of, it's a squared off, you know, sort of like graphed off version of this. And it's interesting that we have that because it allows us to learn something about the way that Pontormo worked. And he, when they were doing conservation, they examined it really closely and, you know, peered under the surface by doing radiographic studies. And they determined that he did transfer the graph. He blew up the graph. You know, it went from an 8x10 piece of paper to this 8x6 panel.
Which was the standard technique that was used at the time.
Yes, although most artists would have, or many, I'm not sure, I think most artists would have done an intermediate step of doing a drawing to scale and then pricking the outline of that drawing, putting it up against the panel that you were going to paint, and then pouncing it with a bag of black chalk. So you take it away and you'd have the tracing of where you want the lines to go. Pontormo, it turns out, just made the big graph and then painted it freehand. And he made a lot of changes, little changes as he went. So it's a very virtuoso way to paint.
And it's painted on wood?
It's painted on wood, yes.
Would canvas have been an option at the time?
Canvas was just starting to be an option, but mostly it was used in Venice. And they did it because they had maritime culture and, you know, Titian was really the first guy to start using it.
Until recently, wasn't the altarpiece only accessible by visiting the church?
Yes, it was. And when I went and I heard someone else who was giving a talk, the same thing happened to them. I arrived in the town. I had to rent a car. I went out to this little town. The church is right by the side of the road. It was locked up. So I kind of had to go knock on doors until I found this old woman who was very happy to take a fairly sizable sum of money, and then she produced a key and went down and unlocked the door and sat there for about 2 minutes and then went away. I could have stolen the painting, right? You know, she didn't stay long.
Well,
once she had the money.
It was a big work.
Yeah, right. But I mean, you know, so much for security.
And I understand the church was in even as more need of repair than the painting.
Yes, actually, I just found this out, but not too long ago, a bus crashed into the church, and now one of the walls has collapsed. Mm. So, you know, one of the points of this exhibition is to raise some money that's all going to go back to the church in Carmignano to make it a place that's safe to reinstall this panel.
I guess it's lucky that the bus hit the church when the painting wasn't there.
Yeah, I think so. Although, actually, the room, the actual church, it broke the wall to the outer, the vestry. So it didn't actually, the painting wouldn't have been in any danger, but still, you know, it's nice to have all the walls intact.
Had the colors been muted over time or just simply covered with all the black gook, the soot?
No, I think the they were just as vibrant underneath all that crime. Mm. Yeah.
So then nobody had to repaint anything.
No. And in fact, they wouldn't do that now. They wouldn't repaint it.
And that's when we found out all sorts of details that we wouldn't have known otherwise, because they covered all they got rid of the varnish and the soot and everything.
Right. When, you know, the conservation goes in, it's a real opportunity to do things like, you know, x-ray it, sort of peer at the wood itself, you know, to look at everything, give it a once-over.
Because there's always the fear that in doing that, you're going to damage the work.
Yes, of course. Yes. And that's why the people who are, you know, the conservationists are really highly skilled people. I mean, they can do incredible, you know, they can peel a fresco off a wall and work on it and put it back on again when they're done. I mean, they can do kind of amazing things now.
I'm talking about an exhibit at the Morgan Library of some works of Pontormo. It runs at the Morgan through January 6th, and my guest is Mary Hogan Camp, who is the docent supervisor at the Morgan Library and Museum and an independent art historian and an expert on Pontormo.
I am painting in oil. Portrait of a man. Ooh. Who has taken all the heartaches. Ooh. And all the pain he can stand.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York. We're at 99.5 FM. I'd like to take a moment to talk to you about an exciting offer that's being made available only this week to listeners of this show. If you make a monthly contribution of $10 or more, we will be happy to say thank you with a 6-month subscription to the New York Review of Books, one of the most prestigious cultural publications in the world. Your donation will automatically be deducted from your checking or credit card account, and it's our way of saying thanks for helping to support Leonard Lopate at Large. So just give us a call at 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Or go to give2wbai.org. That's give and then the number 2wbai.org. And please be sure to note that your contribution is in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. It's a way of supporting this show and everything that you hear on WBAI. So why don't you give us that call now? Again, the number 516-620-3602, or go to give2wbai.org. And thank you. And we're back with our discussion about Pontormo. That song by Screaming Jay Hawkins was about painting a portrait. And Pontormo did a lot of portraits, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah. And that's what I did my thesis on.
Uh-huh. Now, his portraits would we call them realistic? Because I wouldn't say that he is a realist in the sense that Well, I'm not sure too many of the artists of this period were realists.
Well, I think when they came to portraits, you know, there was a lot of airbrushing by everybody, you know.
Making people look better.
Making people look better, yeah. I'm sure that, you know, in some sense. But also, I think Pontormo brought the same set of skills. One of the reasons I wanted to do my PhD on him is that I think many artists when they did a portrait, they just sat somebody down and they caught a likeness and they called it a day. If you look at Pontormo's portraits, there's almost always a kind of mystery or allegory to unlock, and he made every element of design contribute to what he was saying about the person. So they're tremendously interesting objects.
The show at the Morgan includes a painting called Portrait of a Young Man in a Red Cap.
Yes.
Was it painted around the same time as the siege?
Yes, it was. I mean, current scholarship says it was painted during the siege. I argue and believe that it was painted from right before, so I disagree with the current scholarship.
And who might have commissioned the portrait?
Well, most everyone agrees that this is a portrait of Carlo Neroni, and we have, very happily, the Vasari's Life of Pontormo tells us that Carlo Neroni came to Pontormo and requested that this portrait be done.
Vasari, in his 1568 edition of The Lives of the Painters, described Pontormo as a solitary, secretive, and melancholy individual.
Well, yeah.
This is Vasari going after competitors?
This is Vasari being Salieri to Pontormo's Mozart. He wanted his job.
And Vasari was a more prominent figure, wasn't he? Or was Pontormo the big man at the time?
Pontormo was the most esteemed painter in Florence. And you wouldn't know that now, but one thing that proves that, Pontormo died in 1556, and a couple of decades later, there was a chapel dedicated to painters, a side chapel at Santissima Annunziata. And the painters in Florence actually went and dug up Pontormo's body and reburied it because they wanted him to be the first artist to reside in that chapel.
Wow.
So he was really very much recognized as the greatest painter in Florence at the time.
But there were stories about him being a little eccentric. There's one about keeping visitors from interrupting him when he was working.
Okay, this is Vasari.
Vasari again?
Yeah, Vasari is a glad hander and a schmoozer, and he can't imagine that you wouldn't answer the door when somebody knocks. But Pontormo, being the artist that he was, I told you he bought this house and designed it. He put his studio on the second floor, and instead of having a staircase, he had a ladder that went up to it. And when he didn't want to be disturbed, he went up there, pulled the ladder up, and, you know, that was it. He didn't answer the door. You could stand down there screaming. And sometimes Bronzino did. And there's a record of, you know, arguments they got into about this, but he didn't answer the door when he was working.
Bronzino being his student, his follower?
Agnolo Bronzino was his almost like an adopted son. He brought him into his studio when he was 11 years old, and they were close their whole lives.
I would say that today more people will recognize Bronzino's name than Pontormo's
name. Yes,
I
think you're
right.
Why
do you think that is? I mean, Bronzino's a pretty great artist, but so is Pontormo.
I think it has to do with Vasari's Life of Pontormo. I think he... You know, it's funny. I think if I could bring Vasari in here right now and sit him down and say, you wrote a chapter on Pontormo that has trashed his reputation forever, I think he'd be very sorry and he'd be horrified.
There were also hints that Pontormo and Bronzino had a sexual relationship.
I don't think they did. I mean, there is a lot of talk about it. And actually, in contemporary terminology, in Tuscany and in Italy in general, homosexuality was called the Florentine disease. Mm-hmm. So there was...
And a lot of artists were accused of it.
A lot of artists
Leonardo,
were accused.
Leonardo, again.
Yes, yeah. Michelangelo. Mm. But I think both in the case of Michelangelo and...
Botticelli
in the,
as well.
Yeah, but I don't know. There's no evidence that he was either homosexual or not homosexual. And
but
if he
wasn't married.
He was not married, but many artists didn't marry. You really needed more money probably to get married than most of them had.
The painting we were talking about, Portrait of a Young Man in a Red Cap, hadn't it been thought lost for many years?
Yes, that's right. It was, and it wasn't truly lost. It had ended up in the House of the Earls of Caledon in Northern Ireland. It went there about 200 and some years ago, and they inventoried it incorrectly. They said it belonged to a lorry, and they kind of shoved it in a corner and never thought about it again for over 200 years.
Like the Visitation, isn't this the first time that a portrait of a young man in a red cap has been in the United States?
Yes, absolutely.
Also recently restored?
Very recently restored. In fact, we're working on the restoration at the Morgan. I got to see it one day when it was out of the frame, and the restorers were working on it.
And there was a bit of a to-do when it was sold to a collector in the United States.
Yes, that's right. In 2008, Francis Russell, who worked at Christie's as a he's an art historian, but he also was involved with Christie's, was in the Earl of Caledon's house, and he saw it and he recognized it because we did have a print of what this picture was, and it was just believed to be lost. So he identified it, and at that point in time, the Earl of Caledon allowed it to be brought down to the National Gallery in London, and it was there until about 2016, I think. And that's what happened to it.
Now, the figure feels slightly elongated, which I guess is typical of Mannerist paint portraiture, but not elongated in the way, let's say, Parmigianino's Madonna of the Long Neck would have elongated things. But distortion just was part of the style?
Yes, it was. I mean, it's very typical of all of Pontormo's work. I think it gives it an emotional character.
He makes him look a little more elegant.
He's extremely elegant.
What do you think is in the letter he's holding?
Oh, very interesting. Well, no one knows for sure. I have a theory about that. Currently people say he was a soldier of the resistance. But I think that Pontormo set this up where the iconography goes straight down the middle of the painting. He's holding this piece of paper, and he has a tabard, a vest on, mm-hmm. that's slashed. And that's the last word in fashion, the slashed vest.
And he's also has a ring.
He has a diamond ring. And he has this scarlet cap, this tiny scarlet cap on his head. And on the piece of paper that he's either hiding or revealing, you see the letters D-O-M-I. Mm-hmm. D-O-M-I, I think the best reading for it, it's a stem for dominante, which was a word for Florence, dominio, which is the lands around Florence. God is Dominus, and also it even relates to Dominican. And I think he's a later follower of Savonarola, who was advocating the overthrow of the Medici and establishing a Christian New Jerusalem in Florence.
One of aspects of Pontormo's character in his daily life were revealed in his diary.
Yes. Poor Pontormo. Now we talk about his diary.
He wrote down everything that he ate in detail and should I say this on daytime radio?
Yeah,
everything he eliminated?
Yes. This was intake and output in graphic detail.
Makes him sound a little OCD.
Well, it does, you know. And this, again, this is another factor that has contributed to his reputation. Every book, every random book I pick up about Pontormo, it's this crazy guy who ate eggs all the time and talked about his, excretions. But I got really interested in this when I was doing my PhD. And I ended up attending a lot of seminars at the Wellcome Institute in London, which is, dedicated to the history of science. And really what that diary is what a person in the early 16th century who wasn't super wealthy and who wasn't feeling well would do to monitor their health. And he was following a sort of the humors. Like there was a Hippocrates in ancient times had revolutionized what healthcare was by saying it's not magic, it's related to, the real world. And this humoral medicine said that you have these fluids, they're hot, cold, wet, dry, they're bile, blood, phlegm, and if you don't keep them in balance, you get ill.
So while you were conducting research about Bentormo, you try to diagnose his illnesses on the computer?
Yeah, in fact.
Using that information?
I did. I went to one of those diagnoseyourillness.com. This shows how crazy you get when you're doing a PhD. But I went online to diagnoseyourillness.com, and I took out of the diary, I took every symptom. I went in and I said, okay, I'm Jacopo Carucci, because that's his real name. I'm 56 years old, you know, I blah, blah, blah. And then I said, you know, I get stomach pains, I've got these. And so, like, I fill all this out, and suddenly the screen's kind of blinking, like, Mr. Carucci, you should call your doctor right now. And then afterwards, I kept getting these follow-up emails. Mr. Carucci, have you spoken to your doctor? You know, we're still thinking about you here.
So you became Pontormo, in effect, by doing the Myers-Briggs test?
Yeah, I did the Myers-Briggs, too, because I thought, you know, once I was so successful in diagnosing what was wrong. He had a tumor, I think, by the way. I think he was suffering from
it. Is that why he died? Well, he wasn't all that young by the
No, but he died very suddenly.
At the time, he died at 63, yeah. Which probably most people died around 60 or so at that time.
Yeah. No, but he did. He kind of collapsed very suddenly, and he'd been very ill.
What got you thinking about focusing on Pontormo of all artists, especially since there was so little available, despite information about his what could lead you to diagnose his illnesses?
I think I had an experience that I read some other people had with him, and that was in visiting Florence. I one afternoon walked in the chapel of Santa Felicita, on the far side of the Ponte Vecchio, and I saw his deposition in the corner chapel there. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's pale lavenders and blues and pinks and oranges.
Sometimes it feels like the figures are almost floating.
And they felt like they were floating. Yeah, it was beautiful. You know, you shove a kind of euro in the meter and suddenly it lights up and you feel like you're in heaven. So he kind of got me that afternoon. And then also I was intrigued by actually this painting of Carlo Neroni because it was in London and I was working there. And
you were studying in London?
Yes, I studied at the Courtauld Institute in London. And, no one had really written on this, so it was a chance to work on something that had just reemerged.
Are there many Pontormos in the United States?
There are a few. They're scattered widely. The halberdier, another painting of a soldier, is at the Getty. And in Baltimore, there's a wonderful painting of Maria Salviati, who was Duke Cosimo's mother, and of Giulia de' Medici, who was the illegitimate daughter of Duke Alessandro. In Philadelphia, there's a portrait of Duke Alessandro in the period right after his father, Pope Clement, died. It's wonderful.
So mostly portraits in this country?
Mostly portraits in this country, yes.
And would you say that he pretty much split it, portraits and religious paintings, or was he mostly a portraitist?
Well, what we're missing are, you know, we're missing all the frescoes that he did, for the dukes. So he did these big fresco cycles that we, you know, they're just not here anymore. I think what survives are, it's probably evenly divided between portraits and religious panels. He did what came his way, and he did it all brilliantly.
I still, because the work is often so stunning, I'm still confused as to why, if you say mannerist to a lot of people, his name doesn't pop up first. Parmigianino, I guess, maybe because of the Madonna, the long neck, was something that I studied in high school, in the art history class in high school. It's almost like a pop icon in the way that the Mona Lisa is.
Yeah.
Maybe that's one of the reasons that one caught on. But
yeah, it's very interesting, really, that he's so absent from the surveys of art history. He should be there. He is a major artist.
Did he influence artists who followed?
He
other than Branzino?
Did. I mean, just the fact, the anecdote about him being dug up and reburied, he obviously very distinctly influenced several generations after his own lifetime. And I think, Bill Viola is still making art based. You know, Bill Viola's video piece on actually the Visitation is a remaking of that that panel from Carmignano.
And where can we see that?
I don't know. Because, you know, that's about 20 feet tall. That's huge. And it was in the National Gallery in London for a while. I saw it there, and it's fantastic. I don't know if it's permanently installed anywhere. I'm not sure.
How long did it take you to complete your thesis?
Took me 6 years.
Wow, that's a long time. That's because you had to do a lot of searching, or you just had to do an awful lot of Briggs. What is that, Jesse?
The Myers-Briggs.
Myers-Briggs. Yeah.
Well, I started out as an artist, and this was a late life change to become an art historian. So when I arrived at the Courtauld, they were very kind to me, but they told me I had to do a. I'd already done a fine art master's in Chicago at Columbia College, and they said, "Oh, come, no, you got to do another master's here in art history." So I had to do a master's that went on to my PhD. So it took me a while.
The exhibition will be at the Morgan, as I said earlier, through January 6th of next year, and then it'll travel?
Yes, it's going to go to the Getty, where, and I'm very excited about this, the portrait of Carlo Neroni is now going to hang right next to the portrait of the Halberdier, the other soldier that...
Because the Getty owns it, Pontormo?
Because the Getty owns it, yeah. I forget what year, but, you know, that when they bought that, it was $35 million, and it broke all records, and that was, you know, Getty exercising his money muscle back in the day.
Now that's peanuts.
That's peanuts. Yeah, absolute peanuts.
But as you said, there aren't a lot of Pontormos in this country, so that's kind of sad. There's none at the Met?
No, there's none at the Met.
At what point will these two paintings that are at the heart of this exhibit at the Morgan go their separate ways?
At the end of the exhibition at the Getty, then they will. I think that the Carlo Neroni, there was a...
You're calling it the Carlo Neroni,
yeah.
The young man with the red cap.
Young man with the red cap, yeah. I'm exercising my my editorial privilege here. Yeah, young man with the red cap. I believe that has to go back to the UK, where it's the subject of a export dispute.
Still,
yeah. But I'm not sure if it's been resolved. It was purchased by J. Tomlinson Hill, who lives here in New York, and he wants to bring it here. He wants to open his own museum. He has a fabulous art collection, and he wants to open a private museum. So I hope it does make its way back here. But the UK is objecting. Even though they only had it for that brief, you know, from 2008 to about 2015, when it was sold, they had a campaign. When they found out it had been sold, they were really shocked. And they normally expect to be given a kind of six-month chance to raise money and buy it themselves. And so they did this campaign to buy it, and Mr. Hill had paid a huge amount of money for it, I think in the neighborhood of $40 million. And they did raise that money, but here's where contemporary history gets very interesting. Brexit happened. And when they went to hand over the money, the pound had really slipped. And they were about, I think they were about $10 million short. So... there's a dispute now on whether they get another chance to raise that extra money and keep it for Britain.
Keep it in Britain.
Right, where they've cherished it for 8 years.
On the other hand, I'd love to see it in New York.
But
we don't have too many of personal museums of the sort you're talking about. In Los Angeles, there are lots of them.
Yeah.
In New York, it's either the Frick or I guess that's the closest thing to a personal museum.
I'm excited.
Or the Morgan.
I'm excited by the idea of him opening a private museum. I think that could be interesting. He has a great collection, and it would be a whole new, you know, energy here in town. And he's a very knowledgeable collector, so he's interesting.
Meanwhile, it's at the Morgan Museum, Library and Museum, which is on Madison Avenue and 36th Street. Yeah. A wonderful building as well.
Yes, it is. It's always a treat to go in there.
And do we know what's coming in after this?
Yes. After this, we are going to have Tolkien. We're going to have which has just been at the Bodleian Library and broken all records for attendance. It's a lot of the papers and drawings of J.R.R. Tolkien. Mm-hmm. We're having early Renaissance drawings that is... really, it's the show is in honor of a catalog that's coming out, a definitive catalog of all the early Italian Renaissance drawings that are in the Morgan, and that's going to be a really beautiful show as well.
You mean people like Masaccio, Fra Angelico?
I don't think we have any Masaccio, but I think
died young. He didn't leave that much.
Yeah, yeah.
But he did pretty much create the Renaissance.
He did, yes. He's wonderful, yeah.
Well, you've been wonderful, and I thank you so much for being on our show. Mary Hogan Camp, docent supervisor at the Morgan Library and Museum. We've been talking about the current exhibit of Ponturmo, Miraculous Encounters, which runs at the Morgan through January 6th.
Well, it's a pleasure to have been here and an honor to meet you, Leonard. I've always wanted to meet you, so it's great.
Thank you so much, Mary. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Mary Hogan Camp, to Deborah Freeman, who produced this segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who was at the audio controls today. Tune in tomorrow when my guest will be food expert Christopher Kimball. I'm here every weekday on WBAI from 1 to 2 p.m. You can also hear past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter. Also, our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com, where you'll find links to all of our past shows. I'm really thrilled to be here at WBAI doing the show that I've always wanted to do. And a lot of people have written to me and told me that they can hear it in my voice, how enthusiastic I feel about being given a full hour every day to do in-depth stories of the sort that really are very rare in media. But putting a show like this together not only requires a lot of work, it also requires money, and we need the resources to reach out to all the wonderful guests that we hope to bring on, and WBAI has to pay for electricity and phones and rent, and of course, we have all the other expenses you would expect. Our antenna alone costs $12,333 a month. So we're counting on you for a show of support so that we can continue doing this. And if you become a sustaining member for $10 or more, we'd be happy to send you a year subscription to the New York Review of Books, one of the world's great arts publications. We hope that you'll give us that call now at 516-620-3602 to become a sustaining member. If you can't make that, maybe that's a little bit too much for you. Well, any donation, any amount that you feel comfortable with is really welcome. You can also go to the web to give to WBAI.org. That's give and then the number 2, WBAI.org. You can also donate by texting the word WBAI to 41444 and then following the instructions. We appreciate whatever way you give because WBAI really needs your support. And to be absolutely honest, I need that support. And we hope that you'll allow us to continue doing this kind of programming. And thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.